It could work, or it could blow up spectacularly in my face. But right now I don't have another option. I need to find Yuri, and I finally have another lead. I remove the battery from my cell, then find the burner phone. I dial, hold it to my ear, hear Omar pick up. "I need to talk to you," I say quietly, "in private." 2 heartbeats before I hear him say, "Okay. How about the reflecting pool tomorrow morning at 9? "That works." I pause. "Just you and me, okay?" My eyes drift to a photo on the mantle, Matt and me at our wedding. I hear Omar's breathing. "Okay," he says. I arrive before he does, sit on a bench near the center of the pool. The park is quiet, the trees still. The air is cool but holds the promise of warmth. Tourists mill around up near the Lincoln Memorial, little specks of color, but this section of the park is deserted, except for the occasional jogger. There are 3 ducks in the water, a little straight line, ripples cascading around them. How nice it would be if I were here with the kids, if they were throwing little chunks of bread into the water, watching the ducks swim over and gobble them up. I don't see Omar until he's there beside me. He sits down on the opposite end of the bench, doesn't look at me right away. And for a moment, I feel like I'm in a movie, like none of this is real. Then he looks over. "Hi." "Hi." I meet his eyes briefly. There's some suspicion there, but not like there was months ago when we first broke into Yuri's computer. I look away, back to the water. One of the ducks has trailed off, turned himself in the opposite direction. "What's going on, Vivian? Why are we meeting out here?" I twist my engagement ring around my finger, once, twice, a third time. "I don't want to do this. I need your help." He's silent. I've spooked him. This will never work. I swallow. "I need you to trace a call. Tell me everything you can about the number." There's a beat of hesitation. "Okay." I clear my throat. This is a risk. I don't know if this is the right thing to do, but I do know it's the only idea I've had. The only way I might be able to track down Yuri, and he's the only one I can turn to. It was to my phone last night. Unknown number, patched through from Russia. His mouth opens into a little circle, then quickly closes. "I can talk to my boss." "No, you can't tell anyone." His expression darkens. He raises an eyebrow. I can read the question on his face, even without him saying a word. I can feel pinpricks of sweat on my brow. "You know how you said there's a mole in CIC? Well, there's a mole in your department, too. The agency's investigating one." I fight to keep my expression open, honest. Omar knows how to look for lies. I can't give him any of the signs. He looks away, shifts in his seat, visibly unsettled. "You're the only one I trust. We need to keep this between the two of us." He's staring straight ahead out into the pool. I look that way, too. The ducks are back in their straight line, far from us now, moving fast. "What you're asking me to do, trace a call to your cell phone, not document it. It's illegal."
"I need help. I don't know where else to turn."
He shakes his head. "You gotta tell me more."
"I know." I realize I'm twisting my engagement ring around my finger again. It feels wrong, what I'm about to do. I can hear Matt in my head, those words from so long ago. "Whatever it takes, you'd need to forget about me and just do it." It's the sleeper cell. I think I'm close to breaking in.
"What?" he breathes.
"Someone's wrapped up in it."
I hesitate.
"Someone who's important to me."
"Who?"
His eyes are searching mine. I give my head a shake. I need to be sure first. I'm not ready to talk about it. Not yet. Not until I've destroyed anything they can use to blackmail me. There's a jogger approaching on the path, bright pink shorts and headphones in her ears. We watch her pass, her footsteps pounding the dirt in front of us, then trailing off in the distance. Finally, I turn back to him. I'll tell you everything, I promise. Just let me get to the bottom of it first. He runs a hand through his hair, and when he lifts his arm, I can see the bottom of his holster under the edge of his shirt. I stare at it. I can't let you do this on your own, he says. I pull my eyes back to his face and give him my sincerest look. Try to channel all of my desperation into it. Please. I won't tell anyone, just you and me, Viv. We can...
No.
I pause. Look, we're friends. That's why I came to you. You said that if I ever needed help... He runs a hand through his hair again, gives me a long look, hard and worried at the same time. He'll do it, right? He has to do it. He looks hesitant, too hesitant, like he's going to say no. I need something else, something he'd care enough about to bend the rules for me. I think back to the conversation in the elevator months ago. There's a mole in CIC. If you're in trouble, you know where to find me. My throat feels tight. You were right about the mole in CIC. I need to promise him something. I need to buy time. I'll learn more if you trace this number for me.
The numbers connected to the mole and the sleeper cell?
I nod. His eyes search mine, and I can see the excitement, the hunger. I've dangled a carrot in front of him, and he wants it. He wants it enough to do anything right now. Just give me a little time, I say. Finally, he exhales.
I'll see what I can do.
He's going to look into the number on his own. I know he will. There's not a question in my mind. I've started a ball rolling, started a timer that's going to give me the smallest of windows to get to Yuri before the Bureau closes in. I just need to get to that evidence before they do. Maybe it was the wrong thing to do, going to Omar, but I'm in an impossible situation. That call is the only real lead I have. I need to exploit it. Back in the office, I stare at the phone, waiting for it to ring. I catch myself doing it, force myself back to the folder of potential ringleaders, the one that's growing ever so slightly more slim, but only just barely. Every time I hear a phone, I jump, but it's never mine. I try to imagine what Omar's doing. Pray he's not telling his superiors, that they're not calling mine, because someone would make me talk, someone would track down Yuri on their own, and then... where does that leave me? Prison. Another ring, this one finally mine. My hands on the receiver, lifting mid-ring. Hello?
I have what you need, Omar says. O'Neill's in an hour?
I'll be there. I walk into O'Neill's 60 minutes later on the dot. Little bells ring as the door opens, but no one looks up. The bartender's leaning against the bar, pounding out a message on her phone with her thumbs. There's a lone man seated in the center of the bar, hunched over a glass of something amber-colored. A couple's at the table by the front window, deep in conversation. I walk farther in, let my eyes adjust to the dimness. I scan the room, neon-lit beer signs and old license plates and memorabilia from another decade, and I spot him at the back, alone at a table for two, watching me. I walk over and take a seat across from him. He has a glass in front of him, something clear with bubbles. Tonic, maybe, or soda. He's not a drinker, and certainly not the type to drink while he's on the clock. He's giving me an even look. Hard to decipher. I think there's distrust, though. My hands tighten in my lap. This isn't some sort of trap, is it? Has he told anyone else at the Bureau about our conversation? What'd you find? I ask. He looks at me for a long moment, quiet. Then he reaches into a bag at his feet, pulls out a single sheet of paper folded in half, lays it down on the table in front of him. I can see a telephone number on it, handwritten in pen, local area code. Burner phone, he says, and it doesn't surprise me, even if it disappoints me a bit. No other call history. I nod. Please let there be something. Something I can use. Purchased here in the city a week ago. Cell phones plus in Northwest, no CCTV. Records are spotty at best. We've never had luck tracing burners from there. I feel like I'm deflating. Hope draining out of me. How am I supposed to find Yuri with this? Omar's watching me, an expression I can't read. Then he pushes the sheet of paper across the table toward me. I take it, open it. There's a map, a section outlined in red. I look up at him. That's the location of the call, based on the cell tower that pinged. I look back down, examine the map more closely. Northwest D.C., a radius of about 12 city blocks. Yuri was close by. I look up at Omar. Thank you. He stares at me, then sighs. What are you going to do with this? Can't you let me help you?
You said you'd give me time, I remind him. Please, just give me time.
He nods ever so slightly, a resigned nod, his eyes never leaving mine. Be careful, Vivian.
I will.
I fold the paper back in half, then in half again, slip it into the work bag at my feet, then push the chair back from the table, stand to leave.
Thank you again. Really.
He stays sitting, watches me. I sling my bag over my shoulder and turn, and I'm about to take a step when his voice stops me.
One more thing, he says. About that call.
I turn to face him. He gives his head a quick shake.
There was no patch through from Russia.
Chapter 17. I drive home in a daze. I'm doing what I need to do, taking the right route, stopping at red lights, using my turn signal, but it's by rote. Everything around me is a blur. No patch through. That means Matt's not in Moscow. He's in Northwest D.C., in that neighborhood outlined in red, with Yuri. But why? And why did he lie to me?
Something isn't right. Fear is tapping away at the edges of my mind, trying to break its way inside.
When I get home, Mom's in the kitchen at the stove, Matt's place. She's wearing my apron, the one I've had for years, which usually sits in a drawer, untouched. The smells that fill the kitchen take me back to my childhood. Meatloaf, the same kind she's been making since I was a kid. And mashed potatoes, from scratch, loads of butter. Not the kind I buy, pre-cooked, microwavable. There's something so familiar about it, so intensely comforting. I greet her, greet the kids, paste a smile on my face, nod when I should, ask the right questions. How was school? How were the twins today? I'm there, but I'm not present. My mind is on that little box outlined in red. Matt's there, somewhere. Dad sits in Matt's chair during dinner. It feels odd to see him there, like he doesn't belong. Mom squeezes in on the other side of Ella. Too many people at the table, but we make it work. Visions of Matt float through my mind, tied up somewhere, a gun to his head as he talked into the phone and told me he was in Moscow. That's the explanation, right? That's the only one that makes sense, the only way he'd lie like that. I look down at the meatloaf, my appetite gone. Then why am I not panicking? Shouldn't I be panicking? Mom's asking the kids about their day, trying to direct the conversation, trying to fill any silence with words, with normalcy. Dad's cutting meatloaf into tiny pieces for the twins, and they're shoveling it into their mouths by the fistful as fast as he can cut. Ella's answering her questions, chattering away. But Luke's quiet, looking down at his plate, pushing food around with his fork. Not engaging, not eating. I wish I could take this pain away. I wish I could bring his father back, make everything normal once again, bring back his smile. Ella launches into a story about the playground, a game of tag. I look over at her, say the right things in the right places, the little phrases that make her think I'm listening, that make her keep talking. But my eyes keep drifting back to Luke. At one point, I look up and see my mom watching me, concern etched on her face. For Luke, for me, I don't know. I catch her eye and hold her gaze just for a moment. And I know she wants to take away my pain as much as I want to take away Luke's. Later that night, three of the four kids are down, and I'm tucking in Luke. I sit on the edge of his bed and notice his old stuffed bear tucked in beside him. It's tattered now, stuffing peeking through a tear where one ear connects to its head. He used to carry it around the house, bring it to school for nap time, sleep with it every night. I haven't seen it in years. "Tell me what's on your mind, sweetie," I say, trying to strike the right tone, soft, gentle. He grasps the bear tighter. His eyes are open in the darkness, wide and brown and so smart, so much like Matt's. "I know it's tough with Dad being gone," I say. "I feel like I'm floundering here. How am I supposed to make him feel better when I don't know what to say? I can't say his dad will be back. I can't say he'll call. And I certainly can't tell Luke the truth." "It's nothing to do with you or your brothers and sister," I say, then regret the words. Why did I say that? But isn't that what they say to do when one parent leaves? Assure kids it's not their fault? He squeezes his eyes shut and a single tear leaks out. His chin is quivering. He's trying so hard to hold it all in. I stroke his cheek, wishing desperately I could take his pain and make it my own. "Is it that?" I say. "Are you worried you made Daddy leave? Because you absolutely didn't." He shakes his head firmly, sniffles once. "What is it then, sweetheart? Are you just feeling sad?" He opens his mouth ever so slightly, and his chin quivers more. "I want him to come back," he whispers. More tears spill down his cheeks. "I know, sweetheart. I know. My heart is breaking for him. He said he'd protect me." His voice is so quiet, I wonder if I heard him correctly. "Protect you? From that man?" The words make me go still. Fear rushes through me, makes me cold all over. "What man?"
"The one who came to my school."
"A man came to your school?" There's a thudding in my ears, blood pounding through my veins. "Did he talk to you?" He nods. "What did he say?" He blinks quickly, and his eyes get a detached look, like he's remembering something, something unpleasant. Then he shakes his head. "What did the man say, sweetheart?"
"He knew my name. He said, 'Tell your mom I said hello.'"
Another sniffle.
"It was just weird, and he had a weird voice."
A Russian accent, no doubt. "Why didn't you tell me, honey?" He looks worried, scared, like he did something wrong.
"I told Dad."
I swear my heart stops, just for a second. "When did this happen? When did you tell Dad?" He thinks for a moment.
"The day before he left."
It took Matt and me 5 months to get out of the house together after the twins were born, just the two of us. My parents were up from Charlottesville for the weekend. We'd finally established a bedtime routine. The twins were sleeping in their cribs, a long stretch at night, not waking until midnight or so. It seemed like my parents could hold down the fort for the evening. Matt said he'd make plans, and I was happy to let go of the reins, looking forward to a surprise. I thought he'd make reservations at that new Italian place, the one I'd been wanting to try, the one that was far too quiet to take the kids. He wouldn't tell me where we were going until we got there. I thought it was charming, fun, keeping me in suspense. That is, until we got there, and I realized the truth. He knew if he'd told me where we were going, I'd have refused. "A gun range?" I said, staring at the sign out front, a big, ugly warehouse of a building, dirt parking lot crowded with pickups. He pulled the Corolla in, bumped along toward an open spot, didn't answer me. "This is your surprise?" I hated guns. He knew I hated guns. They'd always been a part of my life. My dad had been a police officer, wore a gun every day. And I'd spent every day of my childhood worried that a bullet would find him. After he retired, he still carried. It was a sore point between us. I didn't want guns in our house, ever. He didn't want to be without one. So we'd compromised. He could have his gun when he visited, if, and only if, it was unloaded, locked in a travel gun safe at all times. "You need to practice," Matt said. "No, I don't. I'd been proficient long ago, those first years at the agency, when I wanted to check every box, be prepared for any assignment. But I'd let the certification lapse. I was perfectly happy being desk-bound, close to home. I hadn't touched a gun in years." He put the car into park, then turned to face me. "You do." I could feel anger starting to rise in me. There was absolutely nothing I wanted to do less right then than shoot. This wasn't how I wanted to spend my evening, and he should have known that. "I'm not doing this. I don't want to." "It's important to me." He gave me a beseeching look. I heard shots echo inside the building, and the sound made my skin crawl. "Why?" "Your job." "My job?" I was utterly confused. "I'm an analyst. I sit at a desk." "You need to be prepared." I was exasperated at that point. "For what?" "The Russians!" His outburst silenced me. I had no idea what to say. "Look, you work Russia, right?" His tone softened. "What if they come after you someday?" I saw the worry on his face. I'd never realized before that my job scared him, that he was concerned about my safety. "It's not like that. They don't..." "Or the kids," he said, interrupting me. "What if they come after the kids?" I wanted to argue, to tell him that it wasn't like that, that the Russians wouldn't come after an analyst, not like that, that they certainly wouldn't come after our kids. Did he really think I'd have a job that would put our kids in any danger? But there was something in his expression that stopped me, that took the argument right out of me. "Please, Viv," he said, and gave me that pleading look again. This was important to him. This was weighing on his mind. This was something he needed. "Okay," I said. "Okay. I'll practice." If there's one thing about Matt I know for sure, it's that he loves our kids. From the bottom of my heart, I believe he loves me, too. I may have some doubts. I was, after all, his target. But the kids? There's no question in my mind he loves them. The way he looks at them, interacts with them, that's real. That's why it's been so hard for me to believe that he would have taken off. Left Luke to walk home from the bus stop alone, left the other three waiting at daycare. And that's why now it's impossible for me to believe it. Because if he'd heard that someone had brought Luke into this, there's no way he would have run off and left us. He would have gone after the person who approached our son. Late that night, when the house is quiet, I pad down the stairs and peek into the living room nook over to the pull-out couch where my parents lie sleeping. My dad is snoring softly. I can see my mom's chest rising and falling. I walk quietly to my dad's side of the bed. There's a set of keys sitting on top of the end table. I pick it up. The snores continue unabated. I glance at my mom, see her chest still rising and falling in a steady rhythm. I walk over to their luggage, set against the wall, and open the largest suitcase, lift some folded clothes out of the way, rummage around, until I see it. The travel gun safe, buried at the bottom. I lift it carefully out. I find the smallest key on the ring, slide it into the lock, and turn, hear it click open. I freeze and glance over at my parents, still asleep. Then I open the safe and take the gun out, light in my hands and yet heavy at the same time. I pick up the magazines, the box of bullets, set everything down on the carpet, close the safe, lock it. I put it back at the bottom of the suitcase, arrange the clothes on top. Our deal is Dad can't touch it while he's here. He'll never even know it's gone. I place the keys back on the end table, careful not to let them clang, slide the magazines and the box of bullets into the pockets of my bathrobe, then slip out of the room as quietly as I entered, gripping the gun tight in my hand. Chapter 18. I lie awake that night with the gun on the bedside table next to me. I stare at it in the darkness. This is all surreal. The kids are involved now. It might not have been an explicit threat, but the implication is clear. They'll use my kids as leverage. And that changes everything. I can't stop thinking about that day at the shooting range. Matt wanted me to practice. He specifically mentioned the Russians, too. It's like he knew this day might come, knew I had to be prepared. I roll on my side away from the gun, toward the spot where Matt should be lying. The bed seems especially empty tonight, especially cold. I finally get out of bed. My mind won't shut off, won't let me sleep. I walk through the quiet house. I peek in on the kids, check the locks on the doors and windows the third time tonight. I find my way to the front hall, pull the folded paper from my work bag. Then I take it into the family room, the room where the kids play, where so much of our life has taken place. I sink down on the couch and unfold it, stare at the map, the box outlined in red. Yuri's there, somewhere. The man who approached my son, who terrified him. And Matt's there, too. Something happened to him. He's in trouble. I look at the streets, the pattern of them. I find the one outside my old apartment, the one where we met, just inside the red lines. How has it come to this? Who would have ever thought, a decade ago, that we'd one day be here, blackmailed by the Russians, on the verge of losing everything? I walk into the kitchen, set the map down on the counter, turn on the coffee maker, listen to the rush of the water heating, the squeal of the coffee brewing. I reach into the cabinet for a mug and see the tumbler. I hesitate, ever so slightly, and then I close the door. Coffee poured and mug in hand. I turn back to the counter, look at the map once again. I walked those streets long ago. Matt and I both did. He's there. Somewhere. I just have no idea how to find him. I have no idea what to do. I drain the last of my coffee and set the mug in the sink. Then I grab the baby monitor from the counter, take it with me upstairs, set it on the bathroom counter. I get in the shower, close my eyes, and let the hot water beat down on me, the steam rise around me, until the air is so thick and hot I can barely see, barely breathe. No one is to pick up my kids except our emergency contacts. I say to the daycare director early the next morning. Ella's little hand is clasped tight in mine, enough that she complained as we hurried in from the parking lot. My other hand is holding Luke's. "I can wait in the car," he muttered, but I wasn't going to hear it, not this morning. That's my parents and my neighbor Jane. Her gaze shifts from the bags under my eyes down to my left hand. "If it's a custody issue, we'll need a court, my husband and me, and our emergency contacts," I say, gripping the kids' hands even tighter. "Check IDs if anyone comes, and call me immediately." I write down the burner phone number, then give her my iciest look. No one else. I drive Luke to school, and he's sullen because he wants to take the bus. I peer along the length of the fence, down the tree-lined street, then hurry him into the building, my arm around his shoulder. When we're at his classroom door, I bend down so that we're face to face. "If you see him again, call me right away," I say. I press a slip of paper into his hand, the number of the burner phone. I see a flash of worry, and in that instant he's years younger, my baby again, and I can't protect him. Hopelessness fills me as I watch him open the door to his room. When the door's shut behind him, I find my way to the principal's office. I tell him that Luke was approached by a stranger on school grounds, and I use every shred of anger and indignation I can muster. He's used to it from the other parents here, I'm sure. His eyes widen and the color drains from his face, and he's quick to pledge more security along the perimeter of the school and on Luke himself. I join the morning traffic, begin the usual commute, the mindless crawl toward the city. And I hate it because I should be with the kids. But I can't keep them huddled in the house with me forever, and I can't be at school and daycare and work at the same time. The car inches forward, ever closer to an exit sign. It's the one I used to take to get to my old apartment, the one that leads into the northwest section of the city. I stare at the turnoff, the lane that's clear. And when I'm close enough, I turn the wheel and accelerate. Yuri's there, somewhere. Matt is, too. The exit leads onto streets that are so familiar. I wind through them, picturing the red-bordered box in my mind, navigating until I'm inside it. My eyes are scanning the roads, looking for Matt's car and Yuri's, picking out each and every black sedan, checking the tags. None are a match. I finally parallel park on a quiet street and start walking, my bags slung over my shoulder, the gun tucked in a zippered makeup case at the bottom. The morning is warm already, pleasant. The kind of morning we'd have ventured out in when we lived in this part of the city. Walked to get coffee or breakfast, that little diner on the corner we liked. Memories come flooding back, Matt and me in those early days. Those blissfully happy, uncomplicated days. I walk past my old apartment building, stop in the same part of the street where I bumped into him all those years ago. I picture carrying that box, the collision. I can almost see the coffee stains on the concrete, the smile he flashed at me. Would I change the past if I could? Make it so I'd never met him? My heart feels like it's squeezed tight. I give my head a shake, keep walking. I reach the corner where I stood when I saw him next. The bookstore is long since shuttered, a clothing boutique in its place now. Still, I stare at it, imagine it's the bookstore again, that he's out front, book in hand. The feelings that coursed through me, excitement and relief. Now it's sadness, just sadness. And the coffee shop, the one where we sat at the table in the back, talked until our coffee grew cold. The Italian restaurant, now a kebab place, where we had our first meal. It's like I'm wandering through my life. And it's a strange sensation, because they're the moments that defined me, that brought me to where I am today, and none of them were real. And then I see the bank up ahead, the one on the corner with the domed roof. There's a heaviness in my chest as I look at it, the dome glinting in the sun. I never gave the place a second glance, never had any idea Matt was coming here regularly, meeting with the very person I was working day in and day out to find, while the kids sat in daycare. I walk over, find a little courtyard around the side, a grassy square, trees and manicured flower beds and two benches, dark wood and wrought iron. I look at the one on the right, the one that faces the door. I try to picture Matt sitting there, Yuri doing the same. I sit down on it and look around, see what Matt must have seen, what Yuri would have seen too. The courtyard's empty, quiet. I'm suddenly so conscious of the underside of the bench, the place where Yuri left Matt the flash drive. I reach my hand under and feel around. But there's nothing there. I scoot down to the other end of the bench, feel around underneath. Still nothing. I bring my hand back up, slowly, clasp it in my lap with the other. I blink into the emptiness, feeling numb. It's not like I thought I'd find anything, did I? Matt and Yuri are together. It's just that I don't know what else to do. I have absolutely no idea how to find Yuri, how to find Matt, how to make everything okay. I pull into the parking lot at daycare at 5, the height of the pickup rush hour. The lot's crowded, cars extending all the way into the third row, the one that's usually empty. I see a minivan pulling out of the middle row, and I wait as it backs up, slowly, timidly, then drives off. I pull into the space and park. I'm just getting out of the car when I see him. At the far end of the lot, in the farthest row, his car is backed in, and he's leaning against the hood, arms across his chest, looking right at me. Yuri. I'm rooted in place. Terror creeps into my heart. Him. Here. And what am I supposed to do, ignore him? Come back out with Ella and let him confront me then? I force myself to move, to walk over to him. We stare at each other. He's in jeans and another button-down shirt, two buttons open at the top, no undershirt. His necklace catches the light, shiny gold. His expression is hard. None of this fake friendly stuff anymore. Leave my kids out of this, I say, with more confidence than I feel. I wouldn't be here if you'd just done what I asked. This would all be over. I glare at him. Leave them out of it. This is the last time I'm coming to see you, Vivian. The last warning. He holds my gaze, eyes boring into mine. I hear footsteps approaching and I turn. It's a mother I don't recognize, a toddler on one hip, a preschooler by her side, their hands clasped tightly. She's talking to the older one, not paying the slightest attention to us. They walk to the SUV a few spaces away from Yuri's car. We're both silent as she loads in the kids, gets them strapped in, then gets into the car herself. When her door closes, Yuri speaks again. Obviously, the threat of jail isn't enough. He smirks, ever so slightly, and his hand brushes across his hip, touches the holster through his shirt. But, luckily, I have 4 more points of leverage. My body goes cold. 4. My kids. He's threatening my kids. The engine of the SUV starts. The sound makes me jump. I take a step closer to him. Don't you dare. The smirk deepens. Or what? You see, I call the shots here. He jams a thumb into his chest, enough to make the gold pendant bounce against his skin. Me. The police. I need to go to the authorities, to Omar. Forget the blackmail. Forget staying out of jail. I don't care in the least what happens to me. I'd gladly spend the rest of my life behind bars right now if it meant my kids would be safe. I know what you're thinking, he says, and I blink at him, my attention drawn back, away from what I should do, back to what's right in front of me. And the answer is no. I look at him, his eyes, his expression. Does he really know? Can he really know what I'm thinking? If you go to the authorities, he says, and I realize that yes, yes, he knows what I'm thinking, then you'll never see Luke again. I'm immobile, frozen in place. As he turns around, gets into his car, the one I'd just driven all over D.C. looking for. I watch as he starts it, pulls out of the spot. There are people all around. Parents walking inside, alone, returning to cars toting kids, the smallest ones on hips or in car seats, the older ones skipping along holding hands, little backpacks on their backs. I'm just standing there, staring at the car as it pulls out of the space, out of the lot, and finally turns out of sight. Then a breath escapes me, a great choking gasp, and my legs buckle, suddenly too weak to hold me up. I reach out to the nearest car to keep from falling. Luke, my Luke, how can this be happening? My God. I'll do it. I'll do what he says. I picture the flash drive, inserting it into the computer, letting the Russians in, being responsible for the lives lost, those nameless, faceless individuals whose information makes it into the reports I read, I rely on. At least it's not Luke. I picture his smile, his laugh, his innocence. At least it wouldn't be my baby. Not right now, anyway. I feel like all the air in my lungs is gone again. Because it would be my baby eventually, one of them. It wouldn't be over. He'd know that all he had to do is threaten my kids and I'd do whatever he wanted. It would only be a matter of time before he'd threaten them again. I make my feet move. I don't know how I do it because they might as well be lead. My insides are coiled tight. Everything seems unreal and yet so, so real. I see the front door of the school, but my path's not taking me that way. It's taking me to my car. I get in and fasten my seatbelt, hands shaking. Then I pull out and away, faster than I should. I turn the way he turned, one hand on the wheel, the other reaching into my bag, pulling out the burner phone. I fumble with it, punch in numbers I know by heart, hold it to my ear. Mom, I say when she answers. I hear Luke in the background, talking with my dad, and relief floods through me, knowing that he's home safe. Could you pick up Ella from school? We stood in the farthest lane of the shooting range. I watched Matt load one of the rented pistols, his motions fluid. Shots reverberated around me, loud even through the ear protection I wore. When was the last time you did this? I asked, my voice practically a shout, everything sounding muffled. He'd been shooting before. It was one of those things I knew about him, even if I couldn't remember when I learned it or the details, like fishing and golfing. Ages ago, he answered. He flashed me a smile. It's like riding a bike. I loaded the other pistol as he got the target ready, a paper one, the outline of a person, little zones we were supposed to aim for, chest, head. He clipped it onto the pulley system, sent it to the back of the lane. Ready? He asked. I nodded, got into position, lined up the sights like I'd learned long ago, one eye closed, racked the gun, moved my finger to the trigger, pulled back slowly, the voice of my old instructor ringing in my ear. Let it surprise you. Pop. The gun bounced back hard, my hand, my whole arm moving with it. Like riding a bike, indeed. Everything had come back to me quicker and clearer than I could have imagined. Matt started laughing. "What's so funny?" I said. I could feel my defenses going up. It had been years since I'd shot. He could at least give me a chance to warm up. He pointed to the target. "Look." I followed his line of sight. There, in the dead center of the target's chest, was a small, round hole. "I did that?" He had a big grin on his face. "Let's see it again. Put it right through that hole." I took a deep breath, lifted the gun, aimed. Finger on the trigger. Slow pull. Pop! This time I looked, saw another hole, close to the last one, heard Matt's laugh again. "You sure you haven't been practicing?" he said with a grin. It was my turn to laugh. "Let this be a lesson. Don't mess with me." The grin faded from his face, and he stared at me for a long moment. "Could you do this if you were ever threatened?" I looked at the target, tried to imagine shooting a real person. "No," I answered honestly. "I don't think I could." "If someone threatened you, you don't think you could shoot?" I shook my head. I couldn't picture myself in a situation where I'd ever have a gun. If I were being threatened, I wouldn't want a gun anywhere near me. Odds were I'd be the one who'd end up shot. His eyes didn't leave mine. They were searching, penetrating, making me uncomfortable. So I turned away, back to the target, lined up the sights again. Finger on the trigger. I was about to press down when I heard his voice. "What if someone threatened the kids?" The target morphed before my eyes into a person, a real one, one who was a danger to my kids, one who wanted to hurt them. I pulled back on the trigger, heard the pop. The hole I was aiming for, the first one I made in the center of the chest, had widened just the smallest bit. I'd hit it, dead on. I turned to Matt, my expression as serious as his. "I'd kill him." In a few blocks, I've caught up. I see the rear of his car, that black sedan, a handful of car lengths in front of me. His brake lights glowing red as he stops at a light. I slide down a bit in my seat, a reflex almost, and watch the red spots. I have the Corolla, thank God. I'm as nondescript as he is. Still, though, he could be watching for me, looking for some sort of tail in his rearview mirror. Could be a habit, even. I learned how to do this ages ago. One of those classes at work I never imagined I'd use. Another box checked. I hang back, keep those cars between us, keep myself out of his sight. I watch the lanes on either side, wait for him to switch, to make a turn, anything. Finally, the sedan pulls into the lane on the right. I stay in my lane, hang back, watch. Now will be the test. Is he watching for a tail? Or is he sure I haven't told a soul that I'm crumpled into a ball in the parking lot or dragging myself home, terrified and helpless? A short time later, he turns, and I realize I've been holding my breath. A car behind him turns, too, then another. I could do it, too. There are so many cars following the same path, it wouldn't be alerting. I'm getting closer to the turn, and then I see the sign. The distinctive blue M, a right arrow. The Metro's this way. I look to the right as I approach. The turn leads directly into a parking garage. The sedan is at the gates, stopping for a ticket. I only have a split second to decide. I can't follow him into a garage, too confining. And besides, it's not like I could follow him on foot alone. He'd spot me for sure. I press down on the gas, accelerate past the turnoff. I look as I drive past, see the gate opening and his car driving in. I'm breathing fast now, braking to slow myself. I feel lost now that he's no longer in front of me. But I can't be lost. I can't be helpless. I need to fight. I fumble for the paper in my bag, the one from Omar, pull it out, open it up, my eyes darting between the road and the paper. I look closely at the little map until I see a blue M a metro station in the center of the marked zone. Then I lay my foot down on the gas. It's a long shot, really. I know it is. It could have been part of a surveillance detection route, pull into the garage and out again, continue on his way. And even if he actually got on a train, he could have gone anywhere in the city. Anywhere. But I find a spot along the street nevertheless, one with the metro exit in my line of sight, and I sit, I wait, and I watch. In the silence of the car, I think of my kids. All I ever wanted was to be a good mother to them. And now everything is in jeopardy. Please, God, I whisper, protect them. I haven't prayed in years, and it seems wrong to be doing it now. But if there's even a chance it could help them, it's worth a shot, because every second that ticks by, every second I don't see Yuri come out of that metro exit, makes it more likely this won't work. And if this doesn't work, I don't know what to do next. I cast my eyes up at the roof of the car, like somehow that'll make God more likely to hear. I don't care what happens to me, I say. Please just keep them safe. And I'm incredibly conscious of the fact that my dad's gun is sitting right beside me, buried deep in that bag. I almost don't see him when he emerges from below ground. He's wearing a baseball cap now, a faded red Nationals one, a jacket, too, black windbreaker. He's walking my way on my side of the street, a fact that makes my breathing go shallow, my entire body go stiff. But his head is bent down, the cap the only thing I can see. I watch him from behind a pair of sunglasses, stock still, silently imploring him not to look up. I don't breathe as he passes. And then I exhale noisily, catch sight of him in my rearview mirror, head still down, body hunched forward. I keep my eyes glued on him as he gets smaller and smaller in the distance. Then panic begins to take hold. I need to follow him. I need to see where he goes. But if I pull out now, I'll lose sight of him. I'll have to double back, follow him down the street, and by then he might already be gone, or he might catch sight of me, and it'll all be for nothing. I turn the key in the ignition with trembling fingers, my eyes still on the rearview mirror, on his back, heading into the distance. My eyes leave him for just a second as I check for traffic, get ready to pull out of the spot. They're back on him a second later, and just as I'm about to pull away from the curb, I stop. He's turned. He's walking up steps. He's at the door of a townhouse, letting himself in. A rush of adrenaline runs through me, a burst of relief. I watch until he's out of sight. I memorize the door, blue, the arch above it, white mailbox, three down from the fire hydrant. I reach for the burner phone in my bag, tap the last number I called, hold the phone to my ear. Then I set my eyes back on the blue door. Hello, my mom says. Hi, it's me. How's everything with the kids? Oh, they're fine, dear. They're all home, safe and sound, happy as clams. Thanks for getting Ella. Of course. There's an awkward pause. I hear dishes clang in the background, Ella's high-pitched chatter. I'm going to be late tonight, I say. That's fine, she says. Take your time. Your dad and I can get them into bed. I nod and blink quickly, willing the wall of emotion inside to stay put just a little while longer. I glance over at the bag on the seat next to me, the one that holds the gun. Tell them I love them, okay? Then I angle the rearview mirror down, sink down in my seat, set my eyes back on the blue door, and wait. Chapter 19. It's a few minutes before 10 o'clock in the morning when the blue door finally opens. I've already talked to my parents, apologized for being out all night, made sure the kids are okay. I sit up straighter in my seat and watch as Yuri steps outside. He's wearing a new hat, a black one this time, and track pants and a dark T-shirt. He turns and locks the door, then walks down the steps, head lowered. He presses a button on one of the keys in his hand, and a car across the street flashes and beeps. Another sedan, this one white. He slides into the driver's seat and pulls away from the curb. My mind goes immediately to the kids. But he'd given me time after our talk, time to do what he wanted. They're safe, for now. I take the gun from my bag, tuck it into the waistband of my pants. It's cool against my skin and hard. Then I reach for the credit card that I laid on the console last night and the bobby pin lying next to it, one I dug up from the bottom of my bag, another stray from Ella's ballet buns. It's bent now, the way Marta taught me. I hold them tight in my fist as I slip out of the car, then walk quickly toward the house, my own head down too, like Yuri's. At the blue door I pause, and I listen. I don't hear anything from inside. I rap my knuckles against the door, once, twice. Hold my breath and listen. No sound. A vision floats through my mind again. Matt, tied up in a chair, duct tape over his mouth. I take the bobby pin, slide it into the lock, move it around until it makes contact. With my other hand, I wedge the credit card into the space between door and frame, apply pressure. My hands are shaking so hard I nearly drop the card. I'm afraid to look around, just praying no one's watching, that my body shields what I'm doing from any passers-by. The lock disengages. Dizzy with relief, I turn the knob and open the door a crack, half cringing, half expecting an alarm, something to happen. But nothing does. I open it farther and look inside. A living room, sparsely furnished, just a couch and a big TV. A kitchen beyond that. A carpeted staircase leading up, another down. I step inside and close the door behind me. No mat. But maybe somewhere deeper in the house? And if not, can I at least find the evidence? That file? The one Yuri's using to blackmail me? Suddenly I'm filled with doubt. What if Matt's not here? And I can't find the evidence? Worse, what if Yuri comes back? What would he do if he found me? But I need to try. I force myself to take a step forward, then another. And then I hear something. Upstairs. Footsteps. Oh, my God. I freeze. I pull the gun from my waistband, swing it out in front of me, aim at the stairs. This can't be happening, can it? But it is. Footsteps coming down the stairs now. I'm absolutely frozen in fear. I see feet come into view, bare feet, men's feet. I watch through the sights. Now legs come into view, muscular. Athletic shorts that are too big, too baggy, white undershirt. I keep my gun trained on him, wait for his chest to appear so I can line up the sights. That was quick, comes his voice. Matt's voice. That fact registers at the same time he comes fully into view. Matt. I take my eyes off the sights, look over the gun, into his face. Impossible. But it's true. It's Matt. He sees me and freezes, pales like he's seen a ghost. His hair is damp, the way it is when he's just gotten out of the shower. He looks like he belongs here. I keep the gun pointed at him. A storm of confusion is brewing inside me. Oh, my God, Viv, what are you doing here? He says. And then he's rushing down the last steps toward me, his face open now, full of relief. I wish he would stop. Slow down. Give me time to process this, because this isn't right. None of this is right. I had visions of him tied up somewhere, a captive. Not alone, unrestrained, showering in Yuri's townhouse. He's almost to me now, completely ignoring the gun pointed at him, smiling at me like he couldn't be happier to see me. And I lower the gun because this is my husband I'm looking at, pointing a weapon at. But it's almost hard to do, almost like my arms are protesting or my brain or something. He wraps me in an embrace, but my body stays stiff. "How did you find me?" he asks, incredulous. I still haven't moved my arms, haven't returned his embrace. I don't understand. I don't understand any of this. He pulls away, holds me at arm's length, looks at me intently, his eyes searching mine. "Viv, I'm so sorry. He came to Luke's school. He talked to Luke. I couldn't wait. I had to go." I stare at him, his face so open, so honest. The confusion feels like it's starting to melt at the edges, the smallest bit. It's what I thought, isn't it? He left us to protect Luke, to tell Yuri to stay away from our kids. So why is my mind still screaming that this is wrong? Because he's here alone. He wasn't a prisoner bound to a chair somewhere in the house. That image that was haunting me wasn't the truth. I look him up and down, the damp hair, the clothes. There's a sick feeling in my stomach. "Why are you still here? Why didn't you leave?" He said if I left, he'd kill Luke. The words send a chill through me. Maybe I should have tried. I didn't know if I could take him. He looks ashamed when he says it, and I feel a pull in my chest. "I didn't leave you, Viv. I swear." He looks like he's about to cry. "I know," I say, as much to convince myself as anything else. "I wouldn't do that." "I know, I know." "Do I, though?" His eyes search mine, and then something crosses his face, a brief flash of panic. "Yuri's going to be back soon. He just ran out for coffee. You need to go, Viv." "What?" His voice is urgent. "You need to go. You need to get out of here." A jumble of emotions swirls inside me, panic, confusion, desperation. I need that file, what they're using to blackmail me. He gives me a long look, one I can't read. This is dangerous. The kids, where is it? I watch him unblinking. "You've had time to search." His eyes are boring into me. Then they soften. Upstairs. He did look. He found it. Relief surges through me. "Can you..." I stop mid-sentence, pivot toward the door. There is a key in the lock, scraping, turning. I raise my gun and aim at the closed door, the edge that's going to open any second now. He's back. Yuri's back. I watch the edge of the door through the sights. It opens and I see him head down, a disposable tray in his hand. 2 cups of coffee. He hasn't seen me yet. I keep the sights on him. He takes a step in, starts to close the door, and then sees me. "Don't move," I say. He goes still. "Close the door." I make sure the sights are in the dead center of his chest. If he makes even the slightest move to leave, I'll shoot him. I swear to God I will. This is the guy who frightened my son. He slowly, carefully closes the door. "Hands in the air," I say. I'm surprised by how calm my voice sounds, how commanding, how confident, when I feel none of those things. What I feel is utter terror. He complies, sort of, holds his hands in front of him, the tray extended toward me in one hand, the other open to show me his palm. "Try anything and I will shoot." My voice sounds